people realize, you know, that they're not forgotten. And sometimes when you're in these little villages, you wonder, has the rest of the world forgotten us?
A faith-based food drop in rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 20th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new push to keep permanent fund investments out of Darfur.
We still have a lot of legislators' minds to change, and I think a lot of folks are coming along, but it's not necessarily smooth sailing ahead of here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
Anchorage Acting Mayor Matt Clayman was among dozens of mayors from around the country who met with President Obama today at the White House. They talked about the massive economic stimulus package the president signed into law this week and how local governments can put the money to work. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington, D.C.
Acting Anchorage Mayor Matt Clayman says meeting with the president and vice president and five cabinet members put the stimulus package in a clearer light.
The reason why I came was because we learned a lot more about how to get these projects going quicker and get them into Anchorage in our case, but the other mayors obviously for their communities.
Members of the Conference of Mayors talked with the heads of departments, including energy and education, and got their feedback on how to draw stimulus dollars home. Outside the White House Friday, Clayman said he's optimistic Anchorage can turn around some recent losses, like a delay in putting more police officers on the street.
There's a COPS, or COPS, funding in the recovery package, and I spoke with the Attorney General about that. I'm fairly optimistic that we can get our application in quickly and maybe get that police academy going again before the end of the year.
Clayman also sees the stimulus giving a major boost to a methane recovery project at the Anchorage landfill, which has a $7 million price tag. Much of the stimulus money will go through states and flow to communities, mostly based on funding formulas already in place. But as Clayman explains, other monies can go straight to cities, boroughs, and villages through federal grants.
There's a certain percentages that go through the states, and then it gets distributed by various formulas. And then there's other funds that you apply for them, and you apply as a city as opposed to as a state. And so, for example, on one of the HUD funds, it's 25% is for grant applications direct to the federal government and not through the states. And so that means of the $4 billion, $1 billion will go to people who apply.
The state's biggest city may have been the only one from Alaska represented at the White House Friday, but it's certainly not the only Alaskan community preparing for the influx of stimulus dollars. Fairbanks Borough Mayor Jim Whitaker.
Fairbanks, which is about as far from the national political epicenter as we can be, is no different than any other community in that we take the stimulus package very seriously. We have had a team of people on it since it was first discussed, and now that there is a finished bill, we are seeking to compete for those funds that are available.
Whitaker says when it comes to dollars being funneled through the state, communities don't have a lot to do other than get ready. He's working with the state departments of transportation and education to make sure Fairbanks receives its part of the funds. But when it comes to the money communities must compete for directly from federal agencies, Whitaker says the race is already on.
The grants are being prepared as we speak. The collaborations between ourselves and others, that is to say the university, the school district, the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, the Alaska Railroad, and a host of others with whom we are working, those collaborations are in place.
Whitaker says Fairbanks wants to see money for surface transportation and renewable energy projects. Governor Sarah Palin has criticized the stimulus plan, saying she's concerned it will burden the state with new obligations. Palin says she'll look at the federal funds on a case-by-case basis. Mayor Whitaker and Mayor Clayman say they're not worried the governor might try to reject stimulus money, as some Republican governors have threatened to do. Whitaker says money flowing to communities should not be controversial.
The formula funds, it's my understanding, there are no strings attached to those, and therefore no logical reason why they would be objected to.
Whitaker says beyond that, the governor can do what she sees fit, and communities like Fairbanks will forge ahead to get federal grants.
We are not dependent upon a decision by the governor as to how we might move forward. We are doing what is in our best interest as a community, and the governor gets to make her own decisions with regard to any criteria that she thinks are appropriate.
The money will soon start flowing. For example, in less than 3 weeks, transportation funds will be distributed to states. Alaska is in line for $175 million for roads and bridges. The governor has a 45-day window to take action on the plan. In the meantime, mayors will keep hustling to decide how best to spend the money. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Interior Secretary Ken Salazar announced today he's appointing a task force to help make decisions about where to invest more than $3 billion of stimulus money. The funding has been allocated to the Interior Department, which oversees the National Park Service and the Bureau of Land Management. Salazar is also creating a position of an Interior Stimulus Czar to oversee spending and make sure there's transparency. The secretary says he hopes to have a distribution plan within 2 weeks and says it could create 100,000 jobs across the country. Salazar says he also hopes the stimulus plan has the added benefit of creating lasting value for the American public.
The investments we will make in our American landscapes and icons are the nation's most significant since Franklin Roosevelt in the midst of the Great Depression. And during the actions that were taken during that time, Americans were put back to work building the trails, roads, and water systems and other public lands infrastructure that we still enjoy today.
The $3 billion only covers part of the massive maintenance backlog at America's national parks and wildlife refuges. It includes $500 million for the Bureau of Indian Affairs to replace and upgrade schools and $280 million for the Fish and Wildlife Service. The trustees of the Permanent Fund yesterday endorsed legislation that would require all financial managers to no longer invest in companies that do business in Sudan. Sudan has been blacklisted by international groups and by the U.S. Congress for its genocide campaign in the Darfur region of that country. The fund's executive director, Mike Burns, says the trustees' previous opposition to the bill was a fear of what they call the slippery slope of social investing.
Today it's this, tomorrow it's tobacco, the next day it's somebody else's cause, it's animals that are used in pharmaceutical testing, all that. Yet genocide, you know, rises above all of that clutter pretty clearly.
Burns says the board is comfortable with the current bill. Anchorage Republican Bob Lynn, who sponsored one of three bills calling for divestiture, has scheduled a hearing on the issue for Tuesday morning, where he hopes to move it out of the State Affairs Committee. He says the legislature and the state have a chance to take the moral high ground, and the permanent fund action is what he was hoping for.
I think this may be the turning point for it. I had thought that we might have the votes to get it out of State Affairs Committee previously, but now with this very positive development, I think that would certainly be a help in getting that out of committee. And I think we have the votes, but no smart politician ever says they do.
A similar bill failed to move from the committee last year, but the subject was elevated when Governor Palin enthusiastically supported it before a national audience during the vice presidential debates. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra also sponsored a divestiture bill. He welcomes the permanent fund support, but is not as optimistic as Lynn. He says there's a long way to go.
We still have a lot of legislators' minds to change, I think a lot of folks are coming along, but it's going to be it's not necessarily smooth sailing ahead of here. I think, and Representative Lynn thinks, and the governor thinks that this is the right thing to do. So now we're all on the same page, and the question is whether we can get a majority of legislators. That's not clear yet.
Guerra and Lynn say they've join forces to keep the focus of the bill unchanged, but they have been approached by advocates of other subjects, from anti-abortion to opponents of Iran, to expand the divestiture. Lynn agrees with Burns, the Darfur situation is clearly defined, it is genocide, and Congress has taken action against it. Guerra, too, says it's easy for advocates to try to direct the state's investment decisions. He's heard from and rejected them also.
And at some point, it becomes silly season. What we do know is the state has no business investing in genocide. We know that.
And so today we're saying to the Permanent Fund, and they've joined and they've said, you know, no more investments in genocide. That legislation should pass.
The bill will be heard Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a happy ending to a commercial plane crash near Nome.
As soon as we hit the ground, we made sure everybody was okay. Checked for fire, no fire. So, yeah, we smelled a little fuel, but it wasn't too bad.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska State Elks Association, committed to eliminating the use and abuse of illegal drugs in support of a drug-free environment. Information at alaskastateelks.org. It's never too early to set expectations and goals for your child's education. The UA College Savings Plan provides opportunities that can help you reach your educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. There's more information available by calling 1-888-4 and then Alaska. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs has announced a federal fuel cost assistance plan for Imanik. Senator Mark Begich arranged the announcement during his trip yesterday to Bethel. The BIA's Niall Caesar says the BIA has waived income guidelines so that people can qualify for the aid of up to $1,000. He says they have requested that the waiver also be applied in 56 Western Alaska villages and 11 villages in the Northwest Arctic. In another effort to ease the economic crisis in rural Alaska, Governor Sarah Palin took off with the Reverend Franklin Graham from the Wasilla Airstrip this morning to deliver 200 packages of food to the communities of Russian Mission and Marshall. Graham's Christian relief group, Samaritan's Purse, is planning to distribute hundreds of more boxes throughout Western Alaska next week. The organization has had a presence in Alaska for more than a decade, but has recently stepped up its missionary and charitable efforts in the state. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
As a heavy fog settled on Wasilla, it looked like the Reverend Franklin Graham's plane might not have an opening to land. But by mid-morning, the sun had burned through the haze and he was able to set the King Air 300 down on the snow-packed runway. Graham stepped out of the plane wearing Carhartts and bunny boots and strolled over to greet Governor Palin.
Governor.
How hard did you pray?
We prayed.
Graham is the son of evangelist Billy Graham. He calls the food drop mission an important example of how church and state can work together. He says the church can help by providing volunteers and resources while government steps in to coordinate the effort. Graham says Russian Mission and Marshall are the first of several villages Samaritan's Purse will help in the coming week.
There's huge needs out here in these villages, great needs. But what this will do for their hope, this has been given by churches, by Christians from all across the country. The governor's office is part of this. And I think it's just these people realize, you know, that they're not forgotten. And sometimes when you're in these little villages, you wonder, has the rest of the world forgotten us?
Samaritan's Purse has a long history in Alaska, but the organization has been stepping up its efforts in the state since 2006, when a fire destroyed a school and more than a dozen homes in Hooper Bay. Samaritan's Purse rebuilt 5 houses and a new community center in the village. Last summer, they constructed a dining hall for a Bible camp near Tanana on the Yukon River. Graham says he brings a simple message to the communities he visits.
Every trip I take is a ministry mission. I'm a preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And wherever I go in the world, everyone I meet, even you, I want you to know God loves you.
Religious groups have been bringing similar messages to rural Alaska for more than a century. But in many cases, they've left a horrible legacy. The Catholic Church has been accused of allowing priests and other clergy to sexually abuse hundreds of victims in rural villages. And when many religious organizations moved into communities, they forced Native residents to choose between their own culture and the church. Governor Palin acknowledged that past, but said this faith-based effort is very different and very necessary to help solve the dire economic problems in the region.
I'm dealing in reality with what the conditions are today and understanding that there are good faith-based organizations that have good and sincere efforts that they're putting forth to assist in these areas. There has got to be great oversight, though, so that individuals in these communities never suffer again as they had those decades ago.
Samaritan's Purse says it's currently expanding its base in Soldotna, constructing a warehouse to store tools and other equipment needed for building big projects like churches and community centers. Luther Harrison is director of North American operations for the organization. He says the plan for Alaska is to build at least two large projects in villages each year. And he says the organization has no trouble signing up volunteers.
When we put out our projects like this year, we'll be going to Unalakleet and building a church out there. And our volunteers are already signing up, wanting to come up here. They love the state. You know, they come, I guess, to experience the beautiful scenery, but they get a hold of the communities and start meeting with the kids and the folks in the villages. It's really a great experience for them.
On the Wasilla airstrip, volunteers loaded the last batch of boxes into the nose of one of four planes the organization is using for its rural food drop mission. Samaritan's Purse has 44,000 pounds of groceries to distribute to villages over the next week. Beyond Russian Mission and Marshall, the group doesn't yet know which communities will receive the food. Franklin Graham says he'll work with the governor to figure out where the aid is most needed. In Wasilla, I'm Annie Feit.
Last night at the University of Alaska Anchorage campus, a discussion was held on whether the state of Alaska should devote resources to sustain rural villages. The evening began with a spirited debate by UAA students offering compelling arguments for and against the state ramping up support for services and economic growth in rural Alaska. The student proposals set the tone for the panel discussion that followed and featured both economists and Alaska Native people examining the complex issue. Scott Goldsmith is an economist with the Institute of Social and Economic Research. He says the migration from rural Alaska to urban centers has been going on for 30 years and won't stop. He says he's concerned about continuing the perception that economic development can create cash economies in small, remote communities.
It hasn't happened in the past, and there's no evidence from the rest of the U.S. that communities of this size can become self-sustainable.
Goldsmith says he's also concerned about infrastructure attempts that get done in an incomplete fashion and perhaps would be better not attempted at all if they can't provide the same level of service as found in larger communities. But he asks if it seems fair to subsidize health care and other services in rural Alaska to equalize the service, much as the federally subsidized postal service works.
I don't think that postage stamp rates should be extended to other kinds of public services. But then I think about, well, what about urban Alaska? We're really, all of us, being subsidized. We're all on the dole, right? So that really doesn't work very well.
Aleut Larry Mikuliev says the state should absolutely help sustain rural Alaska, but he says that doesn't mean the people there want something for nothing.
I remember sitting just 6 years ago in front of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council arguing for 1% of the human take of halibut in Alaska's shores for Alaska Native peoples. 1%. And we got a counterargument from a member of the council that said, well, if your population increases, do you want another 1%? Wow. Wow. And they got 98% for what? Sports fishing and commercial fishing.
Paul Unktaguk is with the UAA's College of Education. He says the first thing to ask is for the state to do no further harm in rural Alaska. He referenced abysmal law enforcement in remote communities where people are told they must wait and allow state troopers or poorly trained public safety officers to handle crimes in their villages. He says the state must reach out to tribal leaders
and extend diplomatic relations to the tribes and governances that have been there for thousands of years and say, let's enter into a healthy, respectful partnership in how to resolve these issues. And that would mean allowing tribal peoples to have real powers in Alaska and to welcome them to be partners in starting to solve our own problems.
Ungtaguk also talked about the plight of villages washing into the Bering Sea because of coastal erosion. He says when people wonder why villages were built in such vulnerable places, he gives them a history lesson about the nomadic nature of many Alaska Native people who went to the coast only in the summer.
You had lots of wind, it's easy to dry the salmon, and that's where the sandspit was. And so people were there. The teacher slash missionaries unload the school, put it where the people are. It's the summer camp. Where was the winter camp? In the sheltered area by fresh water in the tree line. So if we have a problem with the infrastructure, location, and cost today, whose responsibility is that? Who do we submit the bill to?
Other areas of discussion acknowledged the difficulty for young people being pulled in two directions, with traditional life on one side and rapid contemporary social changes on the other.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business, or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
All six people aboard a Frontier Alaska flight from Brevik Mission to Nome survived a crash landing yesterday evening thanks to their calm reactions and the hard work of local emergency responders. From KNOM in Nome, Paul Korchin reports.
Frontier Flight 8218 departed Brevik around 6 p.m. Thursday and was reported missing about a half hour later, somewhere east of Nome. An emergency locator transmitter ping initially put the aircraft about 10 miles outside of town. Search and rescue crews set out by snow machine and looked around Cape Nome, finding nothing. They then moved westward toward Army Peak and eventually located the downed Piper Navajo airplane about 7 miles northeast of town, near Newton Peak. Raymond Toktu from Brevik was one of the five passengers aboard, along with his two-year-old daughter, Rosie. Toktu says trouble came upon them quickly in the way of whiteout conditions.
As soon as we hit the ground, we made sure everybody was okay, checked for fire, no fire, so... Yeah, we smelled a little fuel, but it wasn't too bad, so.
Soon after, Toktu started his own fire a little ways from the plane.
Oh, that was just easier for them to spot us, so. That's just common sense. Very fortunate to walk away. And I thank the search and rescue team that went out there.
Search crews say that signal fire proved critical for locating the plane. They transported the passengers and pilot via National Guard SUSV tracked vehicles to Norton Sound Regional Hospital for treatment. Injuries were reported to be relatively minor, including some cuts, scrapes, and bruises. Damage to the plane, which landed upright, was said by responders to be significant, but not severe. The rescue was a multi-agency effort, including Nome Volunteer Fire and Ambulance, police, National Guard, the airport, the hospital, and state troopers. Trooper Aileen Watrosky helped coordinate the rescue and indicates Nome's emergency professionals again stepped up to the challenge.
Nome Volunteer Search and Rescue and Nome EMS, they did a great job and they were very efficient in responding and attending to everybody involved. I think they did a good job with the information that we had. You know, they know the area quite well, so. The hospital staff was very efficient in receiving and treating everybody that came in. It seems that everybody was well prepared for this and it kind of shows.
The precise cause and circumstances involved with the crash are being investigated. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
William Cleeden is leading the Yukon Quest sled dog race. He left the Eagle checkpoint at a little before 2 this afternoon. Hugh Neff and John Little are still resting at the checkpoint. Sebastian Schnula and Brent Sass round out the top 5. Both mushers are en route to Eagle. Hans got scratched from the Yukon Quest in Dawson City yesterday, saying he wants to save his dogs for the Iditarod. Fellow veteran racer Dave Dalton also pulled out at Dawson yesterday because his dogs are sick. That leaves 25 teams in the race. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Most people drop out of dog sled races because their teams are struggling. So when frontrunner Hans Gott pulled the plug yesterday, it was a surprise.
It is very ironic, you know. Here I am in Dawson with a dog team which looks better than
probably in all my other runs in the Quest.
The three-time former Quest champion says he's scratched to preserve what's turned out to be an exceptional dog team for next month's Iditarod.
My goal is to really do well, hopefully win Iditarod this year.
Gott says he sees his team beginning to move toward peak performance and believes his best chance at Iditarod success is to delay that plateau by dropping out of the Quest. He says the decision to scratch was the toughest of his career. Before scratching, Gott was running in fourth place, just 3 hours out of the lead. Brent Sass, who left Dawson yesterday in sixth place, met news of Gott's departure with mixed feelings.
It's a bummer that he's not going to be out there in the trail. It's nice to see him out there, and also good to be racing against him and see where my team is up against his. And I won't be able to compare him at the end of the race now, but it's just kind of unfortunate. But, I mean, it moves me up a spot, hopefully.
Sass began the second half of his Yukon Quest with his usual optimism, and his dogs seemed to share it. Teams depart Dawson from a campground across the Yukon River from town. Mushers set up straw-lined tents for their dogs to rest up in during the 36-hour mandatory layover. Dan Caduce, who's currently running in 10th place, says a simple schedule is employed to help dogs recover from the first half of the race.
Nothing too extravagant. Every 6 hours, they get a feeding, a massage, and a walk.
One musher happy to see his dogs looking peppy again is rookie Jay Kadzow. Kadzow, who's running in 11th position, says his team was depleted because he ran out of dog food on the long run into Dawson.
All the way from Scroggy, pretty much I had nothing. It was a long run. I camped out a couple hours and just gave them water. I thought maybe they were going to quit on me, but they made it.
Kadzow says he should have asked for extra food from race officials, even though it would have cost him a time penalty. He says he hopes his team still trusts him. Further back in the pack, fellow rookie Jason Mackey has been having an even tougher time. The younger brother of the race's four-time champion says his dogs have not recovered since he made the mistake of feeding them heavy and running in the midday sun on the second day of the race. He says they've been plodding along at 6 miles an hour, well short of their normal training pace. Mackey says he's very disappointed, but will not quit.
It's not an option to pull out. I mean, I've put every resource, every person, every response. I mean, I know that there's people at home wondering what the hell I'm doing, you know. I heard that my wife was crying yesterday, you know. We put everything on the line for this race. What's he doing? I'm doing everything I can do. Believe me, there's nobody that needs a paycheck worse than me.
Mackey says he plans to march his dogs through the second half of the race.
Just going to put my headphones on, my running shoes, and work harder than I have been. That group that's in front of me, like from 8th to 15th or whatever it is, better be ready to work because I'm very determined to get in the top.
Mackey says his plan is to do 12-hour runs with 6-hour breaks in between. He says time will tell if his team can handle the aggressive schedule. Reporting on the Yukon Quest Trail in Dawson City, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Paul Korchin in Nome and Dan Bross on the Yukon Quest Trail. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. It's never too early to set expectations and goals for your child's education. The UA College Savings Plan provides opportunities that can help you reach your educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. There's more information available by calling 1-888-4 and then Alaska. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.